I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is non-professional theater. I am a big fan of going to the theater. I love the experience of it. I love seeing people acting live. I especially love musicals live, just the wall of sound as it comes to you from the stage. But for as much as I love a good, huge production at the National Arts Center here where I live in Ottawa, or the times I've been fortunate enough to go to New York City, grew up in the GTA, had the chance to go to theater in the city a few times, I also love going to non-professional or amateur theater, community theater. That can be a lot of fun because you're seeing people on the stage who are there because they love it. It's a hobby for them, as it is for most of the people who are behind the scenes and putting on the production. There's a great sense of community when you go see these shows. You can tell that the individuals on stage, the individuals who are taking your ticket, handing out the programs, that they really love what they're doing and they're passionate about it. So any chance that I have to check out some community theater, I like to do that. And when this book came across my desk, I was very intrigued to get into it because it is about the Alumni Theater Company in Toronto. And it is aptly titled Alumni Theater Company, Non-Professionalizing Theater in Toronto by Robin C. Whitaker, where he goes into the history of North America's longest running women-led theater group, the Alumni Theater Company at the University of Toronto, and gets into questions of how the relationship between professional and non-professional theater works, the practices between the two, the relationships of going from non-professional to professional theater, how one fits into the other, the overall environment of theater across the country. And in doing so, it focuses on four dominant perspectives: theater spaces, festival competition, new play production, and non-professionalizing theater's relationship to the overall theatrical profession. It's a wonderful book that is set in essentially two different sections. There's the history, the programming of the Alumni Theater Company. And then part two is perspective. So it gets into the analysis of a lot of the issues that come out of that history. It's a wonderful way to structure the book. I really appreciated it when I was going through that. You have the history section feeding in to that analysis. Not that there's no analysis in the history section, and not that there's no history in the analysis section, but the separation of the two parts I very much enjoyed. And I think as someone who will very likely go back to this book, it'll be good to orient myself as I go back to it and start to pull things out of it, having it structured in this way. So I very much enjoyed it. And I was very pleased that when I reached out to Robin, he was available to make some time for me to talk about the book. So with that, let's get right into my chat with Robin Whitaker. All right. And Robin Whitaker joins me now. How are you today, Robin?
I'm doing well. How are you, Sean?
Doing really well. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about Alumni Theater Company, Non-Professionalizing Theater in Canada. Now, to get us started, I referenced it a little bit in the intro, but for anyone who doesn't know, what is the Alumni Theater Company?
Yeah, Alumni Theater Company is North America's longest running women-led theater company. People would know them today from their Edwardian Fire Hall at Adelaide and Berkeley Street in Toronto. They've been there since 1972. They've programmed all sorts of plays over their history. These days, definitely focusing on plays by women, about women. A lot of people would know them in Toronto for their new play festival, New Ideas, and also for full-length plays, new plays that they produce at least once a year.
And how did you come to this as a research topic? We were talking a little bit before we started to record. You grew up in Toronto, have a connection to the city, did your PhD there as well. But what brought you to the theater company as a research subject?
Well, I guess I can back up a little bit because my interest in non-professionalizing or amateur theater, I think, started for sure when I was doing my master's degree in Edmonton about 25 years ago. I started there, and Walterdale Playhouse is a prominent company in that city, one of the oldest companies in Edmonton, and they're a community theater. And Some colleagues of mine, you know, said, you know, you should come and check out a show at Walterdale. And I think at the time I was like, oh, it's an amateur theater. I just got to Edmonton. There's more theaters per capita in Edmonton than anywhere else in the country, at least at that time. And I said, you know, there's lots of theater to see. Why would I go and see like a community theater? And, you know, but I also have an open mind, and I said, yeah, sure, let's go. And, you know, it was a great show, and I enjoyed it. And I learned more about Walterdale's place in the Edmonton theater community. And I finished my, and then I ended up being artistic director of Walterdale Playhouse. You know, spending many, many hours, you know, in that theater. They have these like filing cabinets there with you know, old production photos and like on slides and like board meeting minutes and all sorts of fun stuff and posters and old posters from decades ago. And I thought, wow, there's a lot going on here, and they're keeping pretty much everything.
Okay. Yeah. That's what you like to hear. Yeah.
Like to hear. Yeah. You know, and yeah. And so, you know, I finished my master's degree. My master's thesis was on, Sally Clark's plays, a Canadian playwright. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, I really want to keep doing, go on and do a PhD. And really, I think Walterdale was in my mind, and I started to look at other theater companies, and like Ottawa Little Theater, which is Canada's oldest theater company, Alumni Theater in Toronto, Regina Little Theater, Victoria Langham Court Theater, and so on. And, you know, I started to think, wow, I realized there wasn't a lot of research, you know, like what's out there, and there wasn't a lot. So when I got to the Drama Center at U of T, you know, I had pitched this idea, you know, to get in, my proposal to get into the program was to research amateur non-professionalizing theater in the country, and kind of realizing it's most of the theater practiced, you know, most of the theater that's done in this country is going to be outside of the profession in one way or another. But it's also like the least amount of scholarship, you know, right. Scholars focus on professional theater all the time. And there's good reason, as have I've published and presented on professional theaters as well. But, yeah, I thought there was something in there and something pretty big that could be spoken about. And not just sort of with the narrative that first there was amateur theater and then it was professional.
Right.
So that's where it started for me.
Right. So for anyone who's looking at this, because the subtitle, of course, non-professionalizing theater in Canada, and you made reference to community theater. I've gone to community theater. A couple of weeks ago, saw SpongeBob, the SpongeBob musical as a community production. And then you have certainly the case, I'm in Ottawa, so you have things like the National Arts Center. So you have tours come through, they have their own company. Those are professional actors. But is there a clear divide or break between amateur and professional history, or is there, or history, theater? And is there sort of a midway point? Because if you use the sports example, you talk about semi-pro hockey a lot, you know, or that sort of thing. Does the same thing exist in theater? Or are we talking purely community and then professional?
Yeah, I think one of the fascinating things for me about amateur non-professionalizing theater is that it means different things to different people, right? So, you know, in terms of the humans doing it, some, you know, walk into an amateur theater company's auditions and they'll be like, you know, they're thinking, hey, I'll do this show, but eventually I want to be professional. I want to be an Actors Equity member. I want to make a career out of it, right? And sitting beside them waiting to audition could be, you know, a student who, you know, is interested in theater, doesn't necessarily want to make a career out of it, but, you know, wants to get involved in some way. Sitting beside them is someone who's like maybe an engineer with the city during the day, like their 9-to-5 job, right? Yep. And then evenings and weekends, they have kind of an extraordinary talent for theater, maybe because they actually did a conservatory program when they were younger and had planned, for example, to, you know, go on to be a career theater professional. And at one point they were like, I better actually, you know, maybe get a more predictable 9-to-5 sort of income and so on. And then beside them again, you've got people who are, you know, really gung ho to make it work, you know, in their 20s, for example, or late teens, and they're using this as a stepping stone. To me, that's sort of a fascinating cultural nexus, right? With people with different intentions for doing the show, And then maybe if they get cast, then, you know, you're all in it together and you're really, you know what your intention is. You're trying to do the, you know, put it on the play and focus on your part and so on. So it's different for different people. And so the way that I get at that is looking like at Alumni Theater Company as non-professionalizing, because the company itself has rejected going professional, and they've had conversations about, you know, should we start paying people and set up a whole scaffolding to make that work and so on. You know, over the decades, they've had versions of that conversation, and every time they've concluded, no, our value to the city in a given decade has been to provide these kind of varying experiences, you know, to people or an experience to various types of folks coming in to do theater.
Right. And in the Canadian context, not that acting is an easy job anywhere around the world, but in Canada, how important is that non-professional, that amateur side in terms of just the industry of it, of people going from students to amateurs to professionals? And is there enough of a market in Canada that professional theater could even exist without the amateur, the community, the non-professional theater that you're profiling?
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that, and I have argued elsewhere and in the book too, I guess, that amateur and non-professionalizing theaters, in fact, create a cultural interest in theater in a lot of ways, right? So, and it really depends on what city you're in. Like if you're in Toronto, if you're in Montreal, you can probably only see professional theater and you'll feel quite satiated because there's so much theater to be seen. But if you're in a medium-sized or smaller city or town, you might have one or two professional companies, and then you might have three or four non-professionalizing companies. So as far as, you know, getting the idea of theater out to people, to like, talk about at the dinner table, you know, just like, what do you know about theater? Well, I saw, you know, SpongeBob the musical, you know, last week or something, right? Or, you know, I think there's versions of that everywhere. That's sort of the touchstone for people. So that can be a good thing. I think that's a great thing. Like it keeps the idea of theater as an art form out there. And so some people will, you know, if you're in a larger city and you're maybe, you know, you might be more apt to kind of make the comparison where, you know, I saw something at the ANEC, you know, yesterday, and then, you know, a week ago I saw something at a different theater, and then you start kind of comparing. But I found early on, especially in those Walterdale days in Edmonton, like, you know, as much as I might go into an amateur theater show and be like, oh man, that didn't quite work, you know, that kind of fell apart, or it wasn't but I would say there was always a professional, you know, show that I was like, that really didn't hit me. It was pretty disappointing. And so on. So, and there's incredible theater in Edmonton, and there's incredible theater in a lot of places. So that to me was interesting. Like, why is the conversation about amateur theater kind of like, oh, community theater, I know what that's going to be like, versus like, oh, professional theater, yeah, I know what that's going to be like. And I thought it's often a disconnect here. So,
right. Is it, I mean, my gut thought as somebody who goes to a lot of theater is purely expectation, right? When I go into a community theater, I'm thinking, all right, this should be fun. Usually the community theater that I've seen, they have tended to be more fun shows like SpongeBob or like Sister Act, the music, like sort of comedy sort of stuff. Whereas I've only seen heavier, serious dramas by professionals. Mm. And maybe that's part of it too, that just sort of the nature of the show. But my instinct would be that people go into community theater with a lower expectation than they go into a professional theater.
Well, it might be. And I think, you know, a lot of time the audiences at a lot of community theaters will be like family and friends that are coming to see something in the show. And that's that thing. Now, at this point, I need to talk a little about selection of the sorts of theaters that I've decided to research. Because as I've said, I think probably, I'm almost certainly, most of the theater that's happening in this country is actually outside of the profession, even if most of the scholarly interest has been on the profession itself. But I've been rather selective here in the companies I've looked at, like Alumni Theater, Walterdale, Ottawa Little Theater, where they have tended to do the more serious like plays over their history, right? And I've argued that that's why they've been able to stick around for so long. Mm. That they've known what, they've had a real idea of what people wanted to see, but at the same time, there's this level of kind of an education, like a theater education. Like they went to school, they learned about even university, and they learned about drama and like kind of what plays were sort of important, and then had a sense about what the community wanted to see. So the ones I've studied tended not to be kind of, you know, SpongeBob musical,
right,
you
know, yeah,
every year or something. But
yeah.
But sometimes, you know, like Walterdale would always program, you know, like sort of like they did Rocky Horror Show one year, and like, you know, like definitely you want, if you're looking at like five shows in a season, you want one that is almost certainly going to bring everybody in, even kind of the non-theater people.
Right.
So I love that the kind of theaters that I've focused on, I love that they tend to go for variety. So there'll be a comedy, there'll be a period piece, there'll be, you know, probably a musical, there'll be, you know, something, you know, serious, something sort of historical, that kind of thing, that you know, you like your subscriber base or audiences that are going to come to your theater, they're going to like at least one of these things.
Yeah.
That's, and I really kind of focus a lot in the book on programming choices and, you know, what the women at Alumni were sort of thinking when they planned their shows and their season, and, and how kind of savvy they were at making those choices.
Right.
And I admit that it's probably different for other sorts of community theaters that are very much like a bunch of friends get together, even if it's in a like sort of established theater over a decade or more, you know, a bunch of friends get together, say, hey, let's do this show because we want to do it.
Right.
And
yeah.
We know that, and it'll have like 40 people in it, and we know each of our family and friends are going to come. Right. That's a different thing. And I think it's very much worthy of analysis and kind of scholarly attention as well. And you know, my book kind of can allude to that a bit, but definitely the kind of companies that I've chosen to focus on, especially Alumni and Walterdale, you know, they definitely have taken themselves very seriously, see themselves as part of a broader theater ecology, certainly are having fun and doing it because they want to, or they wouldn't keep doing it.
Sure.
Right. But they've definitely got sort of a broader sense of how they fit within the theater ecology in their city and mm-hmm. historically as well, kind of nationally too, back in the mid 20th century when Alumni was with the Dominion Drama Festival competing.
So let's go back to some of those early days for Alumni, and in particular, right after the First World War, it's 1918 where Alumni starts. What is the drive and the push in those early years through the late teens and then through the 1920s, the first part of the book? It's interesting how you've structured the book. The first part is history programming. The second part is about perspectives. I kind of like that, and kind of separating out those two elements of it. But that first chapter goes all the way through until the start of the Second World War. So what is the drive in those early years for these women first to start the company and then to continue to push forward through the 20s and the 30s in an environment, certainly in the 30s, that wasn't the easiest?
Well, for sure, fundraising was the reason early on. So the women who founded Alumni Theater had been very active, most of them had been very active with Women's Dramatic Club of University College at University of Toronto. So alumni AE, obviously at the end, because they're all women, were graduates of University College. And during the First World War, when men were fighting, the male, of course, the theater clubs on campus were divided, men and women. So the male clubs, you know, disappeared during the First World War, but it left the women's dramatic clubs on campus, Victoria College and University College and others, to kind of have the attention of theater audiences, right? Like they were kind of what was left on the home front. And so the Alumni Association of University College Alumni Association hadn't ever done theater before, but it just happened, it would seem, that because they were getting so many graduates coming into their fold as an alumni association who had done so much theater to great attention in Toronto, usually to raise funds, but also out of the elocution tradition, right, where young women would take elocution courses, and often that would be Greek drama or Shakespeare that would be used, right, you know, as a vehicle to learn elocution and to become a proper woman at the time. and to be a societal woman as well, like a woman out in society who can make connections and socialize and move like fundraising around. So 1918, February, there's still a war going on. And so they had been rehearsing in the months before to do a Molière play called Les Femmes Savantes, very self-reflexive kind of a choice for them. And they raised monies for the U of T campus base hospital. They charged, I think it was 25 and 50 cents for tickets. Raised a fair amount of money for the base hospital then. And the war happened to be over, I guess, by November of that year. Yeah. They eventually decided that they'd do it again. And this time they would raise money for campus causes. Like initially it was the bell tower, the memorial tower on the U of T campus. And then very quickly that once they had done that and the bell tower was up, they shifted to raising funds for a new women's union building because that would, I guess, be parallel to Hart House, which was men only at the time. And, kind of fascinating articles in the University of Toronto's Varsity, the undergraduate student newspaper, these debates about the place of women at U of T and why is it that the men have this beautiful, at the time, new and extraordinary kind of building, Hart House. But the women have what was termed at one point a hovel and, just not great, not great living quarters and not great kind of communal quarters for them. So alumni and other fundraising bodies on campus started to turn their attention to raising money for a new women's union.
And how does it go from these individual plays, like goes from a student club to, okay, now we're raising money. How does it go from like one off, two off, three, like at what point does it become this ongoing company? And there's certainly things that go along with being ongoing versus a one-off production. So, how does it kind of become formalized in the way that it becomes its own self-sustaining company and something that has now lasted over 100 years?
Yeah, they were probably, as far as I could tell, the only women's group that was allowed to produce or was allowed to be in Hart House Theater, in Hart House and to use our Hart House Theater. So once a year, the syndics, the board of syndics at Hart House would allow alumni to do a show there. And that really garnered a lot of attention. So I think some people sort of said, oh, it's another Hart House show, but it wasn't. They're allowed to have the space. It's a difference. Like they had the space, but it wasn't a Hart House production. Hart House had its own season. A lot of the same people would come. This became the height of the little theater movement, which is across North America and Europe. And Hart House was a leader on this continent in the little theater movement. They had the best equipped theater for most of the 1920s, in all of North America, actually, in terms of lighting and sound capacity and so on. So alumni were able to use that space once a year in the 20s. And so I think that, so they would do one show a year at Hart House, and then they do like one or two shows at the Women's Union building, such as it was until new one was built. And that theater still exists, by the way. It's the Drama Center at U of T. It's their main theater space now. So they've got they're doing one show a year. It's hard to call it a season yet because I think the Hart House thing had to be booked like 6 months or a year in advance. That show, the main show that they did, was there. The other ones would be like one acts at the Women's Union, and that would be by invite. So you might invite somebody. It was fundraising again, right? So you'd invite people who. Important people. So they eventually, I think, realized through the 20s, I think they felt very focused on fundraising as the outcome and using theater as a vehicle for that. And a lot of the women at alumni would also act in other little theaters around town, and some of them became quite notable. There's several names that people would talk. You see them in the newspapers, in the Mail, and the Globe, and the Star, and so on. And then 1933, when the Dominion Drama Festival begins, this is a nationwide theater festival competition, you know, like sports, right. You know, you'd have governors general would, you know, give their name toward a cup or, you know, and they make sure that a festival happened. And the idea was that competition would improve quality. And in theater in particular, Robertson Davies wrote about this, you know, theater in particular, you'd eventually create a profession because there was, the quality was getting better. People could eventually make it, audiences would want to come and see and pay money. And across, you know, from here in Fredericton where I am, and Halifax and Charlottetown, you know, out to Lethbridge and Victoria, across Canada, you know, little theater groups, high schools would compete at the Dominion Drama Festival. So if you made it past the regional level, which was valuable enough, the regional level, you're seeing all sorts of companies competing and you get to know folks. And every year you might compete with a different company. But then if you made it to the national level, then you were seeing the quality of work in like Red Deer, Alberta, or in Regina, you know, and in even smaller towns sometimes. And you'd see, and you get to you kind of compare like, oh, here's where we're at, here's where they're at. You get to talk to folks. Well, you know, how are you doing such and such? So that the alumni really talked in the 1930s about how they started to take things more seriously then when they started to see like we're actually doing very well. is what they ended up concluding. And they didn't win anything in 1933, 34, or I think 35, but in 1936, they won first or second place at the Dominion Drama Festival. And from then on in, I think they were the only group that had won every male award, like best male actors, best male supporting actor. Because, by the way, in order to be a member of alumni, you have to be a woman, still true today. But men would act as guests. They participate as guests, but it's the women who've always made the programming choices for alumni. So that's, I think it's really in the 30s when the Dominion Drama Festival gave them a bit of a kick, right? Because you start to see where you're at. You're like, oh, we're actually doing this really well, even in, not just within Toronto, but compared to other companies in Canada. And then the Second World War happens and things start to change quite a bit for everybody, but for them in particular.
Right. And so the book gets into the war time, but also the post-war boom. And the way it's said is that there's this expansion and a boom time for theater once the war ends. And I'm curious as to what causes that and how do the community theaters, these companies, you mentioned that the 30s, the 20s and 30s, this expansion of those, how do those theaters respond to this boom in the post-war period?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess you'd say like in Toronto and in a lot of other cities in the country, what had happened was there was like this real enthusiasm for little theater, campus theater in the 1920s and 30s were really, really ticking. You know, new drama programs were opening up across the country as well. The war hits, men go and fight, women are working for the war effort, sometimes also overseas, often at home. Materials, importantly, are now all being directed toward the war effort. So building ephemeral sets for theater, for example, is not really on the docket. Hart House has sort of an interesting history in that because they become, you know, it becomes a building that supports the war effort as it actually had during the First World War because it was unfinished. There was a lot of empty spaces. That's a different story. It's kind of fascinating. Yeah. But yeah, so after the Second World War, then there's just people coming home, you know, what theater are we going to do now? Like, let's get going. Let's restart that. We've been halted here. People who do theater want to do theater. So there was a theater critic in particular in Toronto who kind of created a festival, like the Dominion Drama Festival. It also ceased, of course, during the Second World War. And so this idea of festivals was sort of in people's heads too. And so, Raleigh Young, who had been a theater critic in Toronto, and still was at the time, he created this festival and invited, 16 or 17 Toronto companies together. And what was interesting was those companies identified, like they were big, it was like ballet as well as theater. And some identified as being professional or intending to be professional. Others like alumni I think they were actually referred to as semi-professional then, but, you know, we're non-professionalizing anyways. You know, and then they did like a one act festival as a competition within Toronto, and it kind of got things going. And then when the Dominion Drama Festival kicked in a couple of years after the end of the Second World War, then that became the major festival again with its regional feeder festivals. But that sort of kicked things off. And by within a couple of years after the end of the Second World War, there were, I think I said probably 16 to like 20 theater companies that were starting out anyways and trying to kick back in. And it's from that initiative that you start to see people whose names end up at the Stratford Festival in 1953 mm-hmm. in its first year. Yeah. And kind of these moments, it's interesting to me, these moments where you get like alumni and other non-professionalizing theaters kind of looking at each other and saying like, how are we defining the theater ecology around us? Like what is, right. like we're trying to do theater, but like, what does this theater community look like around us? And still at that point, there weren't any, in Toronto, there weren't really any, there were a couple of professional theaters maybe, or at least some that were claiming to be, but they had to kind of see what would happen after the Second World War. Mm-hmm. So it really was, non-professionalizing theaters that had the way of it for local, right? And then touring groups started to come back as well, professional touring groups.
How does the creation of new plays fit into this, particularly in the second half of the 20th century? Now, the second half of the book, there's a chapter about new plays, but how does it fit into the expansion of theater, the existence of the company itself, how it's surviving, especially through that second half of the 20th century? You talk about the intellectual modernism, the expanding theater ecology from the chapters are dated from 57 all the way to the present, those last two chapters. How do the creation of new plays, the writing of new plays fit into, in particular, that era of the second half of the 20th century?
I point out in the book that alumni had been programming new plays as early as the 1930s occasionally. And that's really outside of what's been recorded in history for Canada. When we talk about new plays, we usually look at the alternative theater movement in the late 60s and 70s kicking things off. The way that alumni went about it, especially by the 30s and 40s are a bit one-off. It's like a member writes a play. But they start to look in the 50s at established authors like James Reaney and kind of collaborating. Like he was a poet, a Governor General Award winning poet, but he was interested in writing a play. And so, a couple of members knew James Reaney personally and approached him. And so his first play is premiered at alumni. So this is kind of the thinking that you weren't just going to like throw a stick and find a playwright in the 1950s or 60s, kind of for both reasons, like theater producers wouldn't take a chance on a new play, right? When you could maybe produce Shakespeare or a British drawing room comedy or something that people might recognize. But on the other hand, that meant that there just weren't playwrights, like you couldn't identify as a playwright. If you know, because that would mean you'd need to be able to make an income, kind of
sure.
you know, and yeah. get a lot of plays produced, right? Yeah. So it was like the perfect storm of nothing happening. but alumni sort of poked at that, right? Like, so they're saying, well, we're a non-professionalizing company. We can certainly pay a little bit to a playwright, of course, for their time to commission. They would even use the word commission, like James Reaney. But it's an author who has a name. So people are going to come to see like, oh, we love his poetry, and we now want, but he's doing a play. Let's go and see the play. Right. And alumni knew that would bring in audiences that maybe weren't usually the theater folks, but it would bring in folks who are interested in like the James Reaney play.
Right.
So they had kind of different versions of that, every few years, in the 50s and 60s where they take like a kind of a known name. 1967 Canada's centennial, they did like an open national call for playwrights to Canadian playwrights to submit their works. And really through the 50s and 60s, especially after James Reaney, I think through the 50s and 60s alumni were getting like unsolicited plays from folks, including kind of known people who were writing plays. Gwen Ferris Ringwald, I think, submitted something at one point, and then so they have a play, alumni had then and now a play rating committee. And so they would kind of vet to say, is this worth us putting it on? Do, you know, I'm thinking like, will people come out and see a play, you know, by this playwright and so on. So they were, so kind of, if you look up like playwriting in Canada, you normally look at the late 60s as being kind of this explosion when you had alternative theaters, like professional theaters, or, you know, like Factory Theater in Tarragon in Toronto, and 25th Street Theater in Saskatoon, and so on, where they were kind of devoted to doing new plays by Canadians, you know, acted by Canadians on usually Canadian-ish topics. Theater Pass Mariah in Toronto doing like documentary theater about Canadian topics and so on. The Farm Show is sort of their famous one. So alumni had kind of been, you know, not necessarily Canadian topics, but they were, from time to time, they were employing commissioning playwrights. Kind of because they could, right?
Right. Yeah. do they benefit, or theater in general, does it benefit from that post-Massey Canadian content push, this desire across the country to create Canadian stuff, whether it's talking about subjects that are specific to Canada, but promoting the idea of Canadian artists, Canadian writers, all that? Like how much does that play into the non-professional theater environment and space for alumni and other companies across the country?
Like, I guess, are you referring to, I guess, the narrative of like a nationalism, I guess?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Cultural nationalism. Yeah. That's what we do. Come on. Right. Like,
exactly. Yeah, precisely. Yeah. Absolutely. Reading theater reviews from like the late 1800s and early 1900s, even like pre-alumni, certainly you had critics who were calling on building like a national theater, right? And whatever that's going to mean. And usually what it meant was, let's borrow from England, but let's push away American sort of commercialism, right?
Of course.
And that was probably true, certainly up to the Second World War. That's sort of how it looked. For alumni, they wouldn't have looked themselves nationally until the Dominion Drama Festival, which had that precise goal, right? To sort of nationalize through professionalizing theater, right? The critic Alan Filewad talks about it, performing the nation back to itself on stages, right? So you write plays and produce plays about the, you know, Canada and like a nation, and then people come and see and they go, oh yeah, we're Canadian. That's what a nation looks like, right?
Of course,
yeah. And so alumni kind of dip their toes into that sometimes, and were sometimes quite successful in that kind of national conversation, especially, I think, probably by the late 60s when, you know, again, other company, like it was kind of the hot thing to, you know, talk about Canada in plays on stage. But, you know, in the 20s, they're doing British drawing room comedies. And so the nationalism there is not about the topic of the play that they're doing. It's that they're employing local people who are Canadian, right? Or not employing, but they're involving, I should say, local people. And so, and when they become successful at Dominion Drama Festival through the 30s and then 50s, and very successful at the Dominion Drama Festival, I think that that's when they start to see themselves as like contributing to this national cause of improving theater. And yeah, I think that that's sort of where it was at. And then also sort of the relationship with the profession, right. Where usually a benevolent kind of a relationship, but sometimes a bit, not antagonistic, maybe antagonistic sometimes.
Now you've mentioned a couple times some of the people who have come out of Alumni Theater Company at Stratford and just prominent within the industry. So what are some of the names that jump out to you, having studied over a century of this company? Just a couple of the names that really stand out to you that have become prominent features that folks might have heard of.
Yeah. Well, William Hutt, who most people would sort of know from Stratford. I think William Needles as well was quite involved. He was also at Stratford for a while. Barbara Barnett, who's interesting because she has a professional career in theater, but she also comes back to alumni quite a bit and is on their executive for many years, even as her professional career is taking off. Molly Tom is interesting. She's still around and doing work with quite active with alumni. And, you know, she had a professional career in kind of theater and film off and on, but, you know, always, I think, saw alumni as sort of her sort of artistic home. Barbara Allen. And yeah, there's like so many of them. I list them in a paragraph or two. But I do so a little bit carefully, right? Because I think, and even now, it's not really where my brain focuses on with alumni. I think it's absolutely essential and important to kind of state the names because it gives you a sense of the value, that part of the value that alumni has had toward the burgeoning profession, really since the mid-20th century. But on the other hand, alumni is valuable in and of itself and not just as a stepping stone for people's careers. R.H. Thompson is another person a lot of people might recognize his name, Toronto actor and director. His mother was very much involved with alumni theater. And so that's, you know, he was cast, you know, when he got older, he was cast in a couple of alumni shows as well before his professional career really took off. So yeah, there's some kind of great stories about that and how, you know, in that respect, alumni becomes important as a stepping stone for people's professions. And they talked about it quite a bit, right? Because you get in the nitty gritty of things when you're trying to cast a show and you're like, oh, I really want that person back. And then somebody says, ah, you know, well, they're touring with a professional company or they're very much, you know, or now they're an equity member, an actor's equity member, you know, can we bring them back? And sometimes quite a few times the conversation was that the actor wanted to do something with alumni, but it became, first it was a bit of a pain. You'd have to like sign, if you were an equity member, you had to sign an amateur theater agreement in order to do a show in the 50s, 60s, you know, 70s, 80s. And then it got a bit more complicated and more difficult. Like you basically be signing to, the company would still have to pay a little bit, which alumni did do, and I believe they still do it now. Sometimes they'll pay a director or an actor in a given show a nominal amount if they're an equity member. But that becomes difficult too, because then do you start budgeting to do that? Yeah. Are you expecting to do that? And then kind of philosophical questions of, are we still a non-professionalizing company? Sure. And so on.
Yeah, when you're paying people, it opens up a can of worms for sure.
Yeah.
So just to sort of take a big picture on the book, and I think non-professionalizing theater in Canada in generally, for anyone who's coming to the book who maybe has never been to an amateur theater, non-professional theater before, or maybe even doesn't like theater, sort of what is your pitch to them to pick up the book, to go through this? You know, I'm kind of the market for this in that I like theater. I go to professional, non-professional theater, so I'm the market for it. But what is the case to someone in Canada who's interested in the history of this, interested in 20th century history, but might not have that interest in theater?
Yeah, in a way, I kind of still see this book as, you know, like a history of Toronto from through the eyes of a theater company. But I think even more broadly than that, it's a history of professionalizing and non-professionalizing practices through the eyes of a theater company. I think if you're interested in, like, one of the things that the book does, I think, pretty well is. It shows a women's perspective about like how women had kind of adapted and showed flexibility from one decade to the next in, you know, in a career or a vocation that was dominated by men in leadership roles, you know, for a long time. And a couple of points in the book, I point out a series of studies that were done in early 1980s and then early 2000s and a couple more since, that kind of track the percentage of leadership roles in theater that are taken up by women. And what's interesting to me, of course, is that alumni has been led by women for now over 100 years. And there's strategies for kind of finding space to do the work that they love, but in a very public setting. I think a lot of people a lot of Canadians will discover that they're related to people who had worked with alumni in one capacity or another. I'm already getting emails from like daughters and granddaughters of alumni members who kind of striking up a conversation. And I love that. So I think that that's part of it. I think that, you know, that the book, the part of the book's broad appeal is that it becomes a really important part of Canadian history, an important part of that national conversation that you brought up, and a really important element of the history of the arts in this country. It's the challenges of it, but its successes. And how kind of women at Alumni really, like, they took the lead on the kind of shows that they wanted to see and that they knew that other people wanted to see in Toronto.
And that's very well said. And clearly we've only just scratched the surface of the book here. So again, it's Alumni Theatre Company, Non-Professionalizing Theatre in Canada. Robin, if people want to pick up a copy of the book or keep up to date with everything else you got going on, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, I think the best way would be to, for the book, is to go to University of Toronto Press online, just Google the name of the book in UTP, and you can purchase it through there, as well as the other online places as well. Very much hoping that it'll be in some bookstores in Toronto and so on, and maybe even eventually libraries, especially at universities. And I keep publishing, so you'll probably see other things by me too. But I'm definitely hoping that people pick up the book and read about this incredible kind of company run by extraordinary women who, just had the perseverance to come together and do this really important theater work over the decades.
Yeah, we will link to the University of Toronto Press page for the book down in the show notes below. So encourage you to check it out. Robin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Okay, thanks so much, Sean. Appreciate it.
So there you have it, my conversation with Robin Whitaker, and I thank him for his time. Once again, the book is Alumni Theater Company, Non-Professionalizing Theater in Canada. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from the Toronto Star, a November 25th, 2024, story by Joshua Chong, A Glimpse Inside Canada's Independent Theater Sector, The Forgotten Lifeblood of the Arts. And in this article, Joshua Chong, who is an arts critic and reporter for The Star, gets into some of the major challenges facing amateur theater across the country, and does so by following a production of Vibrant Waveforms, a musical that was put on this fall at the Tarragon Theatre in Toronto. I would note that a lot of the rehearsals for this actually took place in Georgetown, Ontario, where I grew up, so a bit of a local connection for me in this story. But Joshua goes through and looks at all of the steps along the way, from getting the money to mount a production, the rehearsal process, casting, and how people who are involved in the community and involved in amateur theater, they're doing it after their 9-to-5 jobs. They're doing it nights and weekends and between family obligations, errands, relaxing, finding time for themselves. This is very much a passion project for a lot of these folks. There's personal financial sacrifices that go into it. And for this particular production, they had a budget of $15,000. And they did not recap that $15,000. They only made $5,000. So a loss of $10,000 overall, which was a little greater than they would have expected. But it is kind of a par for the course that a lot of these productions, these amateur productions that are being mounted across the country, aren't intended to make money. They're not profit-driven enterprises. These are, as I said, individuals who are there for the passion of it, the love of it. Some people do get paid along the way, for sure, but overall, it is a passion project. And the importance of amateur theater to professional theater is difficult to overstate, that it can be a feeder system. People get trained in not only what you see on the stage, but lighting, direction, stage management, props, all of these elements that are required to put on a production. Amateur theater can be the entry point for a lot of folks. So you have people who are passionate about it and want to do it because it's fun. Other people, it's a way to get experience and grow towards what they hope is a profession. And all of this merges together in an environment where everyone is just very passionate. So this is a longer form article that Joshua Chong wrote, really very well put together. And I like how he traces this particular production of Vibrant Waveforms and connects it to broader trends across the country on amateur theater. And it, also a lot of these do apply to professional theater, especially as it relates to audiences, as audience for theater is down in Canada since the pandemic, both amateur and professional theater. So the industry is at a bit of a crossroads right now and where it's going to go and how theater is going to respond to the changing audiences in an environment of higher cost. So we definitely recommend this one to you if you're into theater or just generally the arts in Canada, because it speaks to a lot of the challenges faced by arts broadly, not just as it relates to theater, but art in general across Canada. So today's historical headline of the week from November 25, 2024 by Joshua Chong in the Toronto Star, A Glimpse Inside Canada's Independent Theater Sector, The Forgotten Lifeblood of the Arts. And with that, I will say thank you very much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Like, rate, comment, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show and keeps us growing. Of course, you can head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab. All the great written material available on the website as well. And if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's old is news at gmail.com. So with that, I will say thank you so much for listening. And we'll be back with you next week for more What's Old is News.